The Hits.
Cheers.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Susan Shand and Alice Bryant. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Susan Shand.
The coronavirus pandemic is increasing across the United States as infections and hospitalizations rise. This has resulted in a shortage of nurses, especially in rural areas and at small hospitals. The problem has led to nurses being trained to provide care in medical areas where they have little experience. Hospitals are reducing some services to keep enough trained medical workers for seriously sick coronavirus patients. And some health systems are employing traveling nurses to assist their doctors. Nurses with a lot of experience are resigning because they are burned out, said Kevin Fitzpatrick. He is an emergency room nurse at Hurley Medical Center in Flint, Michigan. Several nurses resigned in just the past month. They took jobs in home care or other places with less demands. And replacing them is not easy, Fitzpatrick said. As a result, he said the emergency room is operating at about 5 nurses short of its best level. Each nurse cares for about 4 patients as COVID-19 hospitalizations continue to increase. Experts say the departures are not surprising. Many nurses trained in emergency care are over 50 and at increased risk of serious medical problems if they get the virus. Younger nurses worry about spreading the virus to their children or other family members. Worrying about family members often decides who can actually work and who feels safe working, said Karen Donnellan. She is a professor of U.S. health policy at Brandeis University's Heller School for Social Policy and Management. Donnellan said there is little information so far on how the pandemic is affecting nursing overall, but some hospitals had a shortage even before the virus arrived, especially those in rural areas. With total coronavirus cases above 9 million in the U.S. and new daily infections rising in 47 states, the need for nurses is only increasing. The U.S. has recorded more than 231,000 deaths. The healthcare company Aspirus in Wausau, Wisconsin, is offering an extra $15,000 to nurses with at least 1 year of experience who sign up to work. The company is also using private companies to search for nurses, as the number of patients it treats for coronavirus has increased by 300%. Aspirus operates 5 hospitals in Wisconsin and 4 in small communities in northern Michigan. It is moving nurses from one hospital to another as new outbreaks take hold, said Ruth Risley Gray. She is a vice president and the chief nursing officer at Aspirus. But more nurses are needed. That is because many have gotten sick or tested positive for the coronavirus during the current outbreak. In mid-October, 215 members of Aspirus medical teams were in isolation. They are just beginning to return to work. Adding to the problem is the fact that hospitals nationwide are all competing for the country's available nurses. April Hansen is executive vice president at San Diego-based Aya Healthcare, a company that provides traveling nurses. Her company is seeking to employ at least 20,000 additional nurses. I'm Susan Shand.
The American gambling industry won big on Election Day Tuesday. Three states voted to permit legal sports betting, and three others either approved or expanded gambling in casinos. Casinos are businesses that have gambling and other forms of entertainment activities. Maryland, South Dakota, and Louisiana approved betting on sporting events. The ballot results mean that, by the end of 2021, at least 25 states and the District of Columbia could have legal sports betting in place. The development comes less than 3 years after a U.S. Supreme Court ruling ended a federal ban on sports gambling in most states. It appears that Americans are becoming increasingly comfortable with legalized gambling, said David Schwartz. He is a gambling historian with the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. The state of Virginia approved casino gambling in four places. People in Nebraska voted to permit the addition of casino games at its horse racing tracks. And Colorado expanded the number and kind of casino games it can offer, along with removing some betting limits. In South Dakota, the ballot measure permitted casinos in the town of Deadwood to add in-person sports betting. Deadwood has about 25 casinos. Sports betting will also become legal across much of Louisiana. The American Gaming Association, the casino industry's main trade group, celebrated the expansion votes. Bill Miller, the organization's head, said that, as a result of the successful ballot measures in six states, more Americans will have access to jobs, special tax revenue, and safe entertainment choices where they live.
Imagine that you are interviewing for a job you really want. Most of the questions are in your native language, but the job will require you to use some English. So, the employer asks about your English skills. You might answer with the words, "I can speak English very well," or "I am able to speak English very well." The two statements have the same meaning. Both can and be able to are used to express ability. In a spoken exchange, can is far more common, while be able to sounds less natural. However, when we are talking about the past, the rules change a bit. Today, I will show you how to express past abilities with could, was, or were able to, and another phrase you may have heard before, managed to. The first thing to know is that in the past tense, we express general abilities and abilities at specific times in different ways. That is important, as you will soon see. Let's start with general abilities. These are skills or talents a person once had. In the past tense, English speakers almost always use could. Listen to a few examples.
By the time he was 4, Guillermo could read and write.
In high school, she could beat anyone in a running race.
I could mimic bird sounds when I was younger.
Again, we are talking about general skills or talents, not about a specific occasion. Note that, in any of these examples, was or were able to is also possible, but used less often. You could say, for example, by the time he was 4, Guillermo was able to read and write. And it would be fine. It also might sound a little formal in spoken English. Now let's talk about specific occasions. Here is where the rules change a bit. When we are talking about a specific situation or when noting a specific achievement, we must use was or were able to or managed to. Their meanings are very close. We do not use could. Listen to some examples.
We were able to get a really good price on the car.
We managed to get a really good price on the car.
I was able to persuade her to volunteer at the show.
I managed to persuade her to volunteer at the show.
Now let's talk more about the meanings. Was or were able to and managed to both suggest effort. They mean someone succeeded in doing something that was a challenge or took a special effort. However, the phrase managed to puts a little more emphasis on how hard the challenge was or how much effort it took. Note that managed to is fairly common in spoken English. You will hear it used almost everywhere. Now let's take a few minutes to quickly explore an exception to the rules we just discussed. Earlier, I told you that we use could for general abilities. But there are two kinds of verbs where we also use could for specific occasions. With sense verbs, such as smell and taste, and thought process verbs, such as believe, decide, and understand, we usually use could even when talking about specific occasions. Listen to two examples of what I mean.
I walked past a market today and could smell the freshly baked bread.
We couldn't decide what to get for his birthday, so we bought a gift card.
Note that the second example uses the negative form, couldn't. So now would be a good time to talk more about negative forms. The good news is that we can use couldn't, wasn't or weren't able to, or didn't manage to express the same thing, inability on a specific occasion in the past. Listen to how these are used for the same statement.
He studied for months but couldn't pass the bar exam.
He studied for months but wasn't able to pass the bar exam.
He studied for months but didn't manage to pass the bar exam.
All three sentences mean that a person was not capable of doing something on a specific occasion. Note also that sometimes, for the negative form of managed to, we say couldn't manage to instead of didn't manage to. They mean the same thing.
He studied for months but couldn't manage to pass the bar exam.
Well, that's all for now. Luckily, I did manage to do something today. Teach you how to talk about past abilities. I'm Alice Bryant.
To help protect yourself against the new coronavirus, wash your hands for 20 seconds with soap and water before you eat, after using the toilet, and after touching anything many other people touch, like a seat on a public bus. If you cannot wash your hands with soap and water, use an alcohol-based hand sanitizer that contains at least 60% alcohol. Taking these steps can help prevent not only the new coronavirus disease, but also colds, flu, and other viruses. For more information, visit the following websites: the World Health Organization at www.who.int or the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention at www.cdc.gov.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. The battle between the North and the South spread in the summer of 1861. Union soldiers fought pro-Southern rioters in the streets of Baltimore and St. Louis. A Confederate supporter shot and killed a young officer from the North. Untrained soldiers from both sides fought in the mountains of western Virginia. So far, though, the fighting had not claimed many lives, but very soon the battle would become fierce. Frank Oliver and Jack Weitzel continue the story of the American Civil War.
The old general who commanded the Union forces, Winfield Scott, did not want to rush his men into battle. Scott believed it would be a long war. He planned to spend the first year of it getting ready to fight. He had an army of thousands of men, and it would get much larger in coming months. But this army was not trained. His soldiers were civilians who knew nothing about fighting a war. General Scott needed time to make soldiers of these men. He also needed time to organize a supply system to get to his forces the guns, bullets, food, and clothing they would need. Without supplies, his army could not fight very long. There were many in the North, however, who thought Scott was too careful. It was true, they said, that Union forces were untrained, but so were those of the South, and the Confederacy's supply problems were even greater than those of the Union. The South had much less industry and fewer railroads. It could not produce as much military equipment, and it could not transport supplies as easily as the North could. In the early months of the war, Jefferson Davis, the Confederate president, did not even have guns enough for the men in his army. Those who demanded immediate action expected a short war. They said Scott should take the army and march to Richmond. They were sure that if Union forces seized the Confederate capital, the Southern Rebellion would end. Northern newspapers took up the cry, "On to Richmond," political leaders began pressing for a quick northern victory. Public pressure forced the army to act. For more than a month, General Irvin McDowell had been building a Union army in northern Virginia, just across the Potomac River from Washington. He had more than 30,000 men at bases in Arlington and Alexandria. Late in June, McDowell received orders: march against the Confederate army of General Pierre Beauregard. Beauregard had 20,000 soldiers at Manassas Junction, a railroad village in Virginia, less than 50 kilometers from Washington. McDowell planned to move on Manassas Junction July 9th, but was delayed for more than a week. He planned the attack carefully. McDowell was worried that another large Confederate force west of Manassas Junction might join Beauregard's army. This force, led by General Joe Johnston, was in the Shenandoah Valley near Harper's Ferry, Virginia. Across from Harper's Ferry in Maryland was a Union army almost twice the size of Johnston's. It was ordered to put pressure on Johnston's force to prevent it from helping Beauregard. General Beauregard received early warning from Confederate spies that McDowell would attack. Much of his information came from a woman, Mrs. Rose O'Neill Greenhow. Mrs. Greenhow, a widow, was an important woman in Washington. She knew almost all the top government officials, and she had friends in almost every department of the government. The beautiful Mrs. Greenhow also had some very special friends. One was Senator Henry Wilson of Massachusetts. He was chairman of the Senate Committee on Military Affairs. Another special friend was Thomas Jordan, a Confederate colonel in Beauregard's army.
Jordan asked Mrs. Greenhow soon after the war started to be a spy for the South. She agreed and sent much valuable information about Union military plans. Early in July, she sent word to Beauregard that he would be attacked soon. She also sent a map used by the Senate Military Affairs Committee showing how the Union army would reach Manassas Junction. Then, on the morning of July 16th, Mrs. Greenhow wrote a 9-word message. She gave it to a man to carry to Beauregard. The Confederate general received it that evening. It said, "Order given for McDowell to march upon Manassas tonight."
Beauregard sent a telegram to Richmond. He told the Confederate government that McDowell was on the way. He asked that Johnston's 10,000-man force in the Shenandoah Valley join him for battle. He was told to expect Johnston's help. But Johnston's army was threatened by a large Union force that entered Virginia from Maryland. Led by General Robert Patterson, the Union troops moved toward the smaller Confederate force. They were not really interested in fighting Johnston, but they did want to prevent him from reaching Beauregard. Johnston knew he could not defeat Patterson, so he decided to trick him. While most of his army withdrew and prepared to join Beauregard, Johnston sent a small force to attack Patterson's army. Patterson believed Johnston was attacking with all his troops. He stopped moving forward and prepared to defend against what seemed to be a strong Confederate attack. By the time the trick was discovered, Johnston and most of his troops were at Manassas. General McDowell's huge Union army left Arlington on the afternoon of July 16th. It was a hot day, and the road was dusty. The march was not well organized, and the men traveled slowly. They stopped at every stream to drink and wash the dust from their faces. Some of the soldiers left the road to pick fruits and berries from bushes along the way. To some of those who watched this army pass, the lines of soldiers in bright clothes looked like a long circus parade. Most of these men had not been soldiers long. Their bodies were soft and they tired quickly. It took them 4 days to travel the 45 kilometers to Centerville, the final town before Bull Run. The battle would start the next morning, Sunday, July 21st. The road from Washington was crowded early Sunday morning with horses and wagons bringing people to watch the great battle. Hundreds of men and women watched the fight from a hill near Centerville. Below them was Bull Run. But the battleground was covered so thickly with trees that the crowds saw little of the fighting. They could, however, see the smoke of battle, and they could hear the sounds of shots and exploding shells. From time to time, Union officers would ride up the hill to report what a great victory their troops were winning. In the first few hours of the battle, Union forces were winning. McDowell had moved most of his men to the left side of Beauregard's army. They attacked with artillery and pushed the Confederate forces back. It seemed that the Confederate defense would break. Some of the Southern soldiers began to run, but others stood and fought. One Confederate officer, trying to prevent his troops from moving back, pointed to a group led by General T.J. Jackson of Virginia. "Look," he shouted, "there is Jackson standing like a stone wall. Fight like the Virginians." The Confederate troops refused to break. The fighting was fierce. The air was full of flying bullets. A newsman wrote that the whole valley was boiling with dust and smoke. A Confederate soldier told his friend, "Them Yankees are just marching up and being shot to hell." Neither side would give up. Then a large group of Johnston's troops arrived by train and joined in the fight. Suddenly, Union soldiers stopped fighting and began pulling back. General McDowell and his officers tried to stop the retreat, but failed. Their men wanted no more fighting. The fleeing Union soldiers threw down their guns and equipment, thinking only of escape. Many did not stop until they reached Washington. It was a bitter defeat, but it made the North recognize the need for a real army, one trained and equipped for war. President Abraham Lincoln gave the job of building such an army to General George McClellan.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.